The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Bombas, the best socks in the history of feet. Get 20% off your first order. Go to bombas.com/gym. That's bombas.com/gym. Thanks, Bombas. The Paranormal Podcast is also brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. 5,000 years of wisdom on demand. Check out 3 free episodes of Gaia's great content at jimherald.com/Gaia. That's jimherald.com/Gaia. Thanks, Gaia.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. And we have a great show with you today. We're going to have Dr. Eben Alexander. He's a New York Times bestseller. He's had extremely popular books out talking about his own near-death experience, how it changed his life, and what it has to say to really all of us. And a fascinating interview. Enjoyed that immensely. And then in part two, it doesn't let up. We've got Melissa Alvarez, who is going to talk to us about animal frequency. So really just a great, great two-part show today. And if you enjoy shows like this, please go over to iTunes and wherever you listen, rate, review, and subscribe. Make sure you subscribe if you've got that option. The podcast app, iTunes, wherever you may go. That way we can get the show up on the charts, let more people know about it, and increase the family. I certainly appreciate it. And with no further ado, here we go. It is the Paranormal Podcast. Well, this may be a bit repetitive if you've heard me say this on the program. You know, we talk about a lot of different topics. We talk about ghosts and UFOs and even Bigfoot and things like that. But frankly, the one thing that we all share, and I hate to be the one to break it to you, but everybody listening to this, including myself, we're all going to die. And the question is, what lies beyond? And we have really a fantastic guest who I think is probably in this century thus far has been the biggest voice that there is a very meaningful afterlife based on his own experience. I'm talking about Dr. Eben Alexander. He is the author of the enormously successful book, Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. And he also has out The Map of Heaven, How Science, Religion, and Ordinary People Are Proving the Afterlife. But it wasn't always like that for Dr. Alexander. He spent over 25 years as an academic neurosurgeon, including 15 years at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, the Children's Hospital, and Harvard Medical School in Boston. Now, over those years, he personally dealt with hundreds of patients suffering from severe alterations in their level of consciousness. And many of those patients were rendered comatose by trauma, brain tremors, ruptured aneurysms, infections, or stroke. In his academic career, he authored or co-authored over 150 chapters and papers in peer-reviewed journals and made over 200 presentations at conferences and medical centers around the world. Now, he thought he had a very good idea of how the brain generates consciousness, mind, and spirit. But something happened that changed his life enormously. We're going to talk about it today, and we're so glad to have him with us. Dr. Eben Alexander, thank you for joining us today.
Well, Jim, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So let's talk about Dr. Alexander before the events of November 10th, 2008. You, neurosurgeon, very much an academe. What was your viewpoint on the afterlife and near-death experience in that whole area? What was your attitude on November 9th?
I would say my upbringing was very much influenced by my father. He had been a combat surgeon in the Second World War, came back to head up a neurosurgical training program in the United States, and did that for many decades. He was very scientific, but he was also very religious. His own father had been a general surgeon in Eastern Tennessee and had taken him to the Presbyterian Church there every Sunday of his youth. So for my dad was very comfortable in a world that was very scientific. He followed all the latest developments in physics and in cosmology, obviously in neuroscience, etc. But he was also quite religious and believed in the power of prayer and knew that when he operated on patients and they did well, he attributed most of that healing process to God. And so I grew up in the 60s. Like many of us, I knew that science is the pathway to truth, and I'm more of a scientist now than I've ever been. But I also realize that the simplistic kind of notions of the physicalist position, that is the most prevalent scientific position today, which is called reductive materialism, which basically pretends that the only stuff in the world is physical stuff, and that the brain must somehow create consciousness out of physical matter. That's what I believed. I now know that that's completely false. In fact, one of the biggest smoke and mirrors tricks of the 20th century, in terms of our scientific understanding, 20th and early 21st century, is this false notion that only the physical stuff exists, that in fact our brain creates consciousness out of physical matter. I realize now that the truth is actually something quite the opposite of that. And our entire scientific world is in the process of making this tremendous shift to a deeper understanding. And in fact, my journey from my meningoencephalitis, you know, bacterial meningitis that ended up inflaming my brain through all six layers of the neocortex and all eight lobes of my brain, really shifted everything, because that experience that I had in coma while my brain was being devastated by meningitis has no explanation whatsoever within our conventional scientific thinking about brain creates consciousness.
Now, chances are most of our listeners are somewhat familiar with your story. I mean, you've been on everything, interviews with Oprah, all the major networks, all the major radio shows. But in case somebody was, you know, sleeping or under a rock for the last few years, can you recap what happened to you briefly on November 10th, 2008?
Right. I woke up about 4:30 in the morning with severe back pain, just completely out of the blue. I thought maybe if I could make my way down the hallway into the bathroom and get into a very hot bathtub, maybe that would help. Well, I did that, but the pain just got worse. I almost couldn't even get out of the tub. But I was able to work my way slowly back to the bed, where I collapsed writhing in agony and in a cold sweat. And soon thereafter, I was lapsing into coma. My family ended up calling 911 at that point. The EMTs came to the house, tried to break the seizures. They couldn't. I was deeply in coma by this point already. I remember nothing of those EMTs coming to our house and nothing of the 7 days I spent in coma at Lynchburg General Hospital. And, of course, I found out later through family and friends and the nurses and doctors who took care of me that they took me to the emergency room, did a lumbar puncture, thinking I might have meningitis. Dr. Laura Potter, who was my ER physician, told me many weeks later that when she saw that thick white pus under pressure coming out of the lumbar puncture needle, she knew, especially because microbiology reported back that it was a gram-negative bacterial meningitis, and I'd only spent 3.5 hours from symptom onset to going into deep coma, she knew I was a goner. She knew at that point that I had, at best, a 10% chance of survival, and that number dropped through the week. By the end of the week, day 7 of coma, it was a Sunday, my doctors held a family conference where they estimated I'd gone from a 10% chance of survival down to 2%, and in that unlikely 2% chance that I actually survived, all that really meant was spending a month or so in hospital, being transferred to a nursing home in coma, where I would die never waking up. And that's why on that 7th day, my doctors recommended just stopping the antibiotics. And it was a few hours later, I started coming back to this world. But when I did, my doctors were absolutely right. My brain was wrecked. I had no words, no language, no memories of Evan Alexander's life before coma. My mother, sisters, sons, and other dear family and friends standing at the bedside, I had no idea who these beings were. All I remembered was where I'd been deep in coma, that extraordinary, rich, ultra-real spiritual odyssey that was so shocking in coming back to this world. And it was on waking up that I started having a recovery that modern Western medicine has no explanation for. My words and language came back within hours. My childhood memories within a few weeks. all of my knowledge of physics, cosmology, brain, mind, consciousness came back over about 2 months. In fact, when the memories returned, something I realized in the months and years after that, the memories were more complete than they had been before my coma. And that was a tremendous shock. So all of it is just demands an explanation. And that's what I've been working on the last 9 years, is trying to come up with some kind of an explanation for how all this works.
Now, we're going to get into the experience, but, you know, seeing that you had such a low likelihood of surviving, and if you did survive, it would be in kind of a vegetative state, it sounds like. Do you think that you were brought back to do the work you're doing now? Is that the reason you were in that very, very, very small percentage?
Well, I would say in some sense that that's true, but I believe that there are literally millions of light workers on this planet, all working towards the same goal, to try and wake this world up to the fundamental role of consciousness, of our connection with each other, with all of life, with all of consciousness throughout the universe, and with the divine creative source of this universe. It's really an important message, and it's a message that's been trying to get through to us for thousands of years. It turns out it's a very universal message that brings together the deepest mystical traditions of all the great faiths, whether you're talking about Christian mysticism or Kabbalism, Jewish mysticism, Sufism, Islamic mysticism, Zoroastrianism, Shintoism. I don't care what the faith, it's the deepest mystical traditions where they really converge to a force of unity, a force of oneness, a force where unconditional love has infinite power to heal. And I would also add that it is actually scientific materialism, especially through the profound mysteries of quantum physics, which is trying to tell us something about consciousness and the relationship of consciousness to the physical world, that is a very deep mystery that really makes all of this new in many ways. It's the addition of quantum physics and trying to come up with a sharing of relativity and in quantum physics in what's called quantum gravity into a fundamental understanding of the nature of reality that really incorporates some of this ancient spiritual wisdom and puts together a picture that is much more complete, where we are united through mind. We are all connected through the power of consciousness. And in that sense, truly have linkage to the divine and to powers in this universe that can lead to tremendous healing, oneness, wholeness, if we're simply able to wake up to this deeper truth.
Our guest is Dr. Eben Alexander. We're talking about the afterlife, his experience, and how he's striving to get the word out about the true nature of consciousness. We'll be back right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Bombas, the best socks in the history of feet. And you can get 20% off your first order by going to bombas.com/gym. Now, I love origin stories, hearing how people got their start, people who have done great things. And Bombas is just such a story. 4 years ago, these two guys quit their jobs at a media company to make a difference in the world. And they did it in a very unique way. They've done it with, of all things, socks. And they learned that socks are the most requested items at homeless shelters. And at the same time, they realized there was a gap in the market for a more thoughtfully crafted sock. So they did something that I absolutely love. They did good and they did well. So first of all, they did their research. They spent 2 years on R&D, putting thought into every single detail to engineer the perfect sock. They tore the whole thing down and built it back up. And Bombas was born. And after making 7 substantial improvements to the ordinary sock, their customers overwhelmingly claim they are obsessed with their Bombas because they are the most comfortable socks they've ever worn. And here's where the doing good part comes in. For every pair they sell, they donate a pair to those in need. Over 2 million pairs so far. 2 million pairs. They made a difference to that many people. And they've built a thriving company. And by the way, the socks are dynamite. I absolutely love a couple of the things that they've come up with, the improvements. The one, you know how the old socks, when you pulled them up, they'd fall down? Well, not with Bombas, and I love that. And then secondly, Another thing that's a joy is that little seam by your toes that always would get kind of crunched up and would feel uncomfortable. Well, that's fixed. Plus several other things. And you got to check them out. If you need new socks, you can't go wrong with Bombas. Whether your superpower is moving through Excel with your eyes closed or dominating your rec volleyball league, everyone deserves comfort, and comfort is Bombas' superpower. So here is your special offer. Exclusively 20% off your first order, money-back guarantee, free shipping for orders $30 or more. All you have to do is go to bombas.com/gym. That's bombas.com/gym. And there you'll see the promo code GYM pop up. You just put that in when you do your order and you get that 20% off your first order. I absolutely love Bombas. I think they're doing great work in terms of making the best socks in the history of feet, and some great work in helping people. And my hat's off to them for that. I think you ought to give them a try. Go to bombas.com/gym. That's bombas.com/gym. Thanks, Bombas. Our guest today is Dr. Eben Alexander, and we're talking about the nature of the afterlife, proof of heaven, his experience as a physician and then as an experiencer. Dr. Alexander, talk to us a little bit about the experience, because it is so truly remarkable.
Well, again, it's important to preface this that I found out much later from my medical records and from the scans and neurologic exams that my brain was way too damaged. My neocortex was too damaged to support anything more than just the most rudimentary of kind of hallucinatory experiences. It was certainly in no position to manufacture the extraordinary ultra reality that I witnessed. Now, it all started as a primitive kind of coarse underground realm that I call the earthworm's eye view, like being in dirty jello and this feeling of roots or blood vessels all around me. And it seemed to go for a very long time. I had no memories at all of Eben Alexander's life when I was in that place. No words or language, no knowledge of earth or humans or anything. It really was an empty slate. But I didn't stay there forever. There came a slowly spinning, very clear white light that had fine white and kind of silvery and golden tendrils off of it, and it was slowly spinning. As it came towards me, I realized it was packaged with a beautiful, perfect musical melody. And this musical melody proved very important later, because by remembering the notes of the melody, I was able to conjure up this beautiful, clear, spinning white light that served as a portal from that ugly, kind of confined, suffocating earthworm eye view up into a brilliant, ultra-real valley that I came to call the Gateway Valley. And in this valley, I had no body awareness at all, but I was a speck of awareness on a butterfly wing. And this was one of millions of butterflies, and they were all looping and swirling in these vast spiraling formations. And we were over this lovely valley, and the valley was filled with lush life, and everything was growing and fertile. There was no sign anywhere of any kind of death or decay. And there were thousands of souls dancing in this valley who I weeks later in my writings, as I was trying to record all this, I said that they were dressed in simple peasant garb. But I saw these as souls between lives. And there was lots of joy and merriment and children playing and dogs jumping, just incredible festivities. And it was all being fueled because up above were these swooping golden orbs of light, leaving sparkling golden trails against this blue-black velvety sky. And it was all lit by these billowing clouds of pure color. And these swooping orbs, they appeared to be singular spiritual beings that I later called angelic choirs. These did not appear to be beings that had ever been incarnate, but these were the higher forms, the guides. And they were emanating these chants and anthems and hymns that would thunder through me and just enliven the incredible beauty and the unconditional love and healing power of that entire realm. And in that realm, as I witnessed all those souls below, I realized I wasn't alone on this butterfly wing. There was a beautiful girl. And of course, she proved to be a very central figure in my journey. I came in my writings to call her my guardian angel, and she had soft brown hair and sparkling blue eyes and high cheekbones and a very broad smile, high forehead, and she smiled at me with this beautiful, loving smile of infinite love, and she never said a word. She never had to, because her thoughts came into my mind telepathically. And even though those thoughts originally were just the pure conceptual flow, weeks later when I was trying to write it all down, the words I put down for her thoughts coming into my mind were, "You are deeply loved and cherished forever. You will be taken care of. You have nothing to fear." And also a lesson that I wish I'd clarified a little better when I wrote it in Proof of Heaven, but you can do no wrong. And what she really meant by that is this is soul school. We, of course, have the choices. We can make our choices in dealing with others out of love and compassion, forgiveness, acceptance, and mercy. And that will provide the most direct pathway of ascendance towards oneness with the divine over multiple incarnations. But we have the choice to do otherwise, to choose away from love and compassion and forgiveness, to be selfish or greedy, to hand out pain and suffering to others. But if we make those choices, we are simply choosing a much more arduous pathway. That's what she meant by you can do no wrong. In other words, I already knew at that point that this was very much about living and learning the lessons of this life by facing the challenges and hardships, and that certainly includes illness and injury, but doing so in such a manner where ideally we remember our connection to the divine and to each other, and we remember how the best way to manifest love and comfort, joy and harmony in our own lives is to serve as a conduit for those very same kind of synthetic and loving properties of that spiritual world and bring those into our lives in this world. In fact, the deepest and most profound lessons of near-death experiences really concern how we live our lives here. It's not so much a focus on what it's like after we leave this world, especially when you come to realize that the only way to make sense of it all is to acknowledge that reincarnation is the best way to interpret that eternity of soul. So we each come back here many, many times, but there is a kind of a programmed forgetting that goes on so that when we come into these incarnations, we don't necessarily have all the knowledge of our higher soul that we regain when we reunite with a higher soul, either at the time of our death when we leave this particular incarnation, or we can achieve that through deep meditation and centering prayer and other means of going within consciousness in our lifetime to come to realize that our souls come back again and again. There's an emerging field of what's called transpersonal psychology, which has everything to do with helping people recover those memories of between lives and past lives. And that kind of puts the whole tapestry of our existence into a far richer and more complete light to make sense of our existence and make sense of this life that we're living here. But it is very much about that evolution of all of consciousness. And each and every one of us is participating in that in our soul journeys by being here to learn and teach, to overcome the hardships of our lives, which are really just the stepping stones that allow for the growth of our souls. So I think it's a whole new worldview that became much clearer to me after my coma journey, and especially in the years since then, in trying to make sense of it all.
Now, did God play a part in this? Do you think you went to the place where God lives?
Well, absolutely. That deity that I encountered, that I describe in the core realm, because this Gateway Valley with this beautiful girl on the butterfly wing was just kind of a halfway point, because in fact, as the music of that beautiful spinning melody had opened a portal, taking me up from the earthworm eye view into that rich, ultra-real Gateway Valley, so filled with the beautiful kind of heavenly features in form of angelic choirs, but also with all the souls between lives, the girl on the butterfly wing, and all of the lessons there. But the angelic choirs and the music and the chants and hymns that they were provided also offered yet another portal into higher and higher levels. And ascending through all of that, I saw all of space and time collapsing down in this lowest material realm, including what I call deep time, which is kind of the temporal ordering of causality in those higher spiritual realms, which is what allows for any number of things to happen in this realm, because time flow in this realm is very much built in as an illusion, as part of the maya, part of the appearance of the world that supports this stage for our drama to unfold. But there's a much deeper ordering of spiritual temporal causality that I call deep time, that was very apparent in that Gateway Valley and beyond. And I saw all of that collapsing down as these angelic choirs in the Gateway Valley provided yet another portal up to higher and higher levels until I reached what I call the core. Infinite inky blackness, but filled to overflowing with the infinite healing power of that divine love of the Creator. Now, before I left that Gateway Valley realm, I sensed this beautiful breeze that I described in Proof of Heaven. It was a perfect summer breeze. It was really my first remembering of the healing power of that unconditional love of that deity, of that God, and then ascending up to the core realm, where I experienced that full-blown and became completely one with that force, which, of course, there's no way to translate into human language anything that remotely reflects that kind of journey. And yet that's very much a part of the realization I came to see that we are directly connected with that deity. But, of course, when I came back to this world and was writing it all up and trying to describe it, I realized that we get so lost in trying to decide, well, should we call that deity God or Allah, Brahman, Vishnu, Jehovah, Yahweh? The words we get lost in, our language is so confusing. And of course, the orthodoxy of religious positions also tends to confuse us because it tends to force us to believe that we somehow have to choose among those deities, whereas in fact the deepest mystical traditions of all the great faiths point to a similar power of that infinite kind of love and connection that we all share. And when I came back to this world, to me the word God was a puny little human word that had way too much baggage. And this deity was really much more awesome and powerful than anything I had ever envisioned in my Christian upbringing before. So I called this deity Om, because to me that Om was the sound that I heard in that core realm. When people would ask what was the origin of that Om, about the best I could offer is it was the kind of resonance that you would encounter in a cavity of infinite dimension, infinite space, and all of eternity, which is what that core realm is, that pure oneness with absolutely no distinction of anything, just pure source of universe. And that pure source is something that we witness as an infinite healing force of love and of connectedness. And of course, that's what near-death experiencers bring back by the millions. That's what the prophets and mystics who gave us all of our religions, which I would say all came from the same space that near-death experiences report, that's really just something that has been conveyed to us over thousands of years, but then the message gets distorted. The original message coming from the prophets is distorted by others who try to use it to control people, and I think that can be dangerous. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some beautiful qualities of our modern religions when they focus on the oneness, the connectedness, that we're all together. This is all about love. But as soon as Orthodox religion starts to preach a separateness and that we're better than the others and that we're in conflict and we must go to war with others over this belief in deities, then you know that those religious leaders or church fathers or what have you have led us way off the pathway of the original teachings of the prophets. And that's something we need to return to. And that's what this awakening that is very much fueled by quantum physics and by the deepest studies of the nature of consciousness and relationship of brain and mind, that's what we're waking up to now.
Now, I have to get this piece of the story in because to me, this is such an affirmation and a validation. The young girl that accompanied you on this. You didn't recognize her at the time, but you seemed to have a very great connection. But after your experience, something remarkable happened. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, this is a bit of a spoiler alert to any of those who have not read Proof of Heaven, because I believe this is part of the book that really gets people's attention. And it absolutely shocked me into an understanding that was very profound as I talk about Proof of Heaven. But to get to the story that you're referring to, I have to give a little bit more backstory. And that has to do with the fact that I was adopted, that my birth mother was a sophomore in high school, And my birth father was a senior in high school, and there was really no way that they could work out to keep me. And as much as my birth mother tried to keep me, there was no way that social services in North Carolina in 1954 were going to let an unwed teenage girl keep her baby. And so she had to give me up when I was 4 months old. I was adopted into a very loving and wonderful family. I've already mentioned my father, who was such an influence in my life, the neurosurgeon, who was very religious, very scientific, but also very much believed in the healing power of love and the power of prayer and in a loving personal God and the reality of an afterlife. So all of that was important to me, but that was in my adoptive family. And like many adoptees, when I was a teenager and in my early 20s, I would write letters to the North Carolina Children's Home seeking, you know, is my birth mother looking for me or not? I always got the same answer. No, she's not. So go back to your life. You can forget about it. And so I let it all go. Back in my mid-20s, I decided, okay, well, that's fine. You know, I was adopted into a loving family and my life was going well. So I had no regrets, and people had made promises back in the 1950s that they were still honoring. So I just let it all go. Now, like so many things in our lives, there are those things that make such an import at the time, we can't understand why they happened or why we might have chosen them. Difficult hardships that we only later come to realize were important in our soul growth. Well, likewise, there are those things that seem very trivial at the time they happen, and yet we find out much later they have a tremendous impact. One such feature in my life has to do with the fact that my oldest son, Evan the Fourth, when he was in sixth grade in Dover, Massachusetts in the year 2000, he had a school project in family genealogy. And so he was urging me on to find out more about my birth family. I thought, okay, fine, I'll humor him. Wrote another letter to the children's home asking if there was any more information about my birth mother. And I remember I was driving up to go skiing in February of 2000, going from Boston up to Maine in a blizzard. My son, Evan the Fourth, was in the back seat of the car. He was going skiing with me. I remembered, oh, yes, maybe now I should call this social worker at the children's home. She told me that that day she might have information. So I called her up. She said, well, I did find something out. Are you sitting down? Well, I was driving through a blizzard. And she said, well, your birth parents got married. And I cannot tell you what a shocker that was. That absolutely was something I'd never considered as a possibility. And that's when Betty, the social worker, said, and there's more. At which point I did pull over to the side of the road. And that's when she told me that they had, my birth parents had three children, that my youngest sister had died 2 years earlier. That was in 1998, that they were still grieving her loss. So it was not a good time to come back in their lives. And that was over 2 minutes in that phone conversation. I perceived that as a rejection by my birth mother, and it sent me into a tailspin. Even though my official response consciously at the moment was just to stuff it and say, well, who cares? I came to realize much later that that phone call led to a dark night of the soul, really. I stopped saying prayers to my sons at night. I stopped taking them to church. And that really lasted for 8 years, right up until the time of my coma. And I promise you, what I witnessed in my coma changed all of that forever. But important to point out that a year before my coma, that would be 7 years after that revelation, that sense of rejection by my birth mother, my sister's walking on a beach in South Carolina and said, well, don't you think it's time you reached back out to your birth family again? Of course, my first response was no, because I remembered how that had kind of kicked me over the edge of the abyss back in February 2000. But they were right. There was a hole within me that really could not be filled without at least trying again. So I wrote another letter to the children's home. This time I got a very positive response. And October 5th of 2007, I walked down a sidewalk in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and the door opened, and for the first time in 54 years, I was hugged by my mother. And then minutes later, I was hugged by my father. And the next day, I met my brother and sister. They then went on to meet aunts and uncles. They all got to meet my adoptive family, but it was always a bit bittersweet because there was a little teeny bit of information about Betsy, but not really very much. It was obviously still a very painful topic for them, and I really missed Betsy and wanted to know so much more about her. I remember my birth sister, Kathy, promised to one day send me a picture of her, and that picture did arrive 4 months after my coma. And I'll never forget taking it out of the envelope, and Kathy had emblazoned this beautiful poem on the picture. The poem's called When Tomorrow Starts Without Me by David Romano. It's a beautiful poem. It's in the book Proof of Heaven. And as I read that poem, my eyes just filled with tears, and I just collapsed on the floor just over this horrific tragedy of losing this beautiful birth sister who I never even knew about until 2 years after she died. And I remember I was just sobbing, just overcome with the tragedy of her loss and knowing about that, and put it up on the dresser. And the next day I was in that same room reading Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's book, Life After Death. And she has a beautiful story in there about a 13-year-old girl who has a profound illness and coma, is welcomed to that heavenly realm by her brother, who shows her that same infinite healing power of unconditional love, helps her to make a decision to come back to this world. And when she does so, she's recovering from her illness and out of coma, and she's talking over with her father, and she says, "But I don't understand. I don't have a brother." And he said, "Well, you did, but he died 3 months before you were born, so we never told you about him." And that's when I looked up on my dresser at that beautiful picture of my birth sister. It's almost as if she was looking at me as if to say, "Do you finally get it?" And it was the beautiful girl on the butterfly wing. And I'd been so shocked. I had told my family and friends all about the beautiful girl on the butterfly wing. But of course, the more I read about near-death experiences, the more I realized she had to be somebody who was crucial to me in my life. And yet I remembered her so perfectly, I knew I had never met her. And that's why this revelation was so shocking. And it really tied together all the pieces of the story for me and made me realize that the reason that whole deep spiritual journey in coma seemed way too real to be real was because it really happened. And of course, it was only long after that, as I read more and more near-death experiences, that I realized that more than half of them, and in some studies up to 90% of them, remark on this extreme ultra-reality, how that world is much more real than this one. This material world that we live in is very dreamlike by comparison. And finding out that that was a very common experience, not just for me, but for tens of thousands of others who have gone on to report near-death and share-death experiences and after-death communications at all, where they are convinced of beyond any doubt of the reality of that connection. And this is why my life partner and I, Karen Newell, are so busy giving workshops, or what we call play shops, in meditation and going within, because using differential sound frequency to go deep within consciousness is a way that I've returned to those realms and developed a very lively and interactive relationship with that beautiful girl on the butterfly wing, and with other entities, and with that incredible infinite healing power of pure love, that God deity that brings a healing force to this world. But we can all come to discover this by going within, and that's why I do all the work with Sacred Acoustics. And those who are interested in learning more should visit sacredacoustics.com. There's some free offerings there that allow people to download some differential sound frequency tones, listen to those through headphones, and follow the simple free directions that Karen offers in her teaching videos at sacredacoustics.com. And others can come to learn this long before leaving this physical realm, learn the reality of our spiritual souls, of our interconnectedness with all, and of the deep divine nature of our very soul and existence.
Now, I know we're running short on time, but I have a few brief questions I want to get in. And in this one, I think I have to ask, so pardon my directness in this regard, but there are people out there listening, or maybe your former colleagues or people who say, "Look, Dr. Alexander, you may be very well-meaning, but you had this great trauma. Maybe there was some hallucination involved, and what you're seeing is just that. It isn't representative of everything, anything." What would you say to those skeptics?
Well, I think the important thing, this is why I'm often asked to speak to medical and surgical groups, is they realize that this kind of meningoencephalitis with E. coli, that is the worst kind of bacterial meningitis you can have, to be thrown into coma by that illness over 3 hours, to spend 7 days in that coma, and then to come back to this world with a brain that's completely wrecked, but then recovers literally over hours and days and over 2 months of full recovery is so extraordinary and unheard of that it demands some kind of explanation. That's the other thing that is so shocking and makes these kind of near-death experiences so incredibly worthwhile, is they bring the reality of miraculous healing right into our midst. My healing, of all the doctors who took care of me would agree, it's an absolute miracle. There are other stories out there like mine. For example, Anita Murjani, who had a stage 4B lymphoma, and by all rights should have been dead back in February of 2006. And she was in coma, 85 pounds, her body riddled with cancer. And yet, when she had her near-death experience, it was clear to her that the cancer would vanish. And it did. I just gave talks this weekend with Mary Neal, an orthopedic surgeon, who was put underwater in a kayaking accident for 30 minutes. Nobody lasts 30 minutes underwater and then has a full recovery of function. But she has. So miraculous healing is within our grasp as we come to realize that NDEs offer us much more than just evidence that the afterlife is real. And so the reason I'm often asked to talk is because my kind of severe gram-negative bacterial meningoencephalitis is a perfect model for human death. These are not hallucinations or dreams or drug effects. Mine in particular, my neocortex was gone. It was wiped out. My doctors knew that. That's the reason I could not have had any kind of hallucination. The fact that these memories do not go away is another stunning feature of near-death memories. There is a group headed up by Dr. Laureys, L-A-U-R-E-Y-S, in Belgium, where they looked at the quality of memories from NDEs and found out that they are such a high quality of memory of kind of connected events and reality that do not fade over time, that you cannot look at them as a memory of a dream or hallucination because they are so much more resilient. Dr. Bruce Grayson, who has researched NDEs more than any other MD on earth, has also written up on how durable these memories are. I have people share near-death and shared-death experiences with me that might have happened 50 or 60 years ago, and they say it's as if it happened yesterday. So these are not hallucinations or dreams. They're extremely common. Most of your listening audience will encounter these, either in themselves or in loved family members or what have you. They're extremely common. So if we're going to understand our human existence, we really need to have a much better understanding for this. And that involves a much better understanding of the nature of consciousness and the mind-body relationship. There's one book out from the medical literature that I'd highly recommend. It just came out in the last month or two. It's called The Science of Near-Death Experiences. And that book is put out by John C. Hagen and Missouri Medicine. And it's all about physician perspectives on the deeply profound spiritual nature of these experiences, why they cannot simply be explained away as physical hallucinations of the brain. Also, I'd like to mention Karen Newell and I, my partner, have recently written Living in a Mindful Universe. That book will be coming out in October of 2017, and it will be our version of trying to really put all this together into something that makes sense in terms of the science, in terms of the spirituality, which we see coming together very, very quickly.
Oh, that's fascinating. One last thing, and then we'll let you again reiterate where people can connect with everything you do. How has this changed you? Obviously, you've really focused a lot on this, getting the word out about this epiphany that you've had and the nature of consciousness. But otherwise, how has it changed you as a person?
Well, it's really changed everything because I've come to completely flip my notion of the relationship of brain, mind, and consciousness, know of the absolute reality of the infinite healing power of that deity at the core of all existence, the reality of that God, but a God that is absolutely all-inclusive, that we're really all in this together. And I cannot tell you how important this kind of shift in understanding is to me in my understanding of the world, and therefore it is so crucial to get out to this world. we painted ourselves into a corner. We really are in some deep difficulty with our addiction to fossil fuels and destruction of the climate, and we really need to take responsibility and stewardship of this planet, and that's a big part of what this awakening is all about. It's also high time that we got rid of warfare. There hasn't been a war in a very long time that's actually been there for any good reason whatsoever. So we really need to promulgate more of peace and living together, harmony, and sharing love with all of our fellow beings. This is not just about humans. We also are sharing a peaceful coexistence on this planet with animals and plants. And we really need to awaken to this deeper reality about who we are and where we're going and what is the purpose of our existence.
Doctor, where can people go if they want to find out more information about everything you do? Obviously, the books are available, I think, pretty much everywhere, but where would you direct folks?
Well, people can go to Eben Alexander, that's E-B as in Baker, enalexander.com to learn more. You can also visit sacredacoustics.com to learn more about meditation, to download some free meditation files or sound journey files, learn more about it. And look forward to our new book that Karen Newell and I are writing. That book will come out October 17th of 2017. It's called Living in a Mindful Universe, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Heart of Consciousness. And it will go deeply into all of this and how the whole world is shifting around this deeper knowledge about brain-mind consciousness and the nature of reality.
Our guest today has been Dr. Eben Alexander. Dr. Alexander, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Jim. It's been great being with you. I look forward to talking again.
What a fascinating interview with a fascinating man, Dr. Eben Alexander. As I've said many times, that is my favorite topic of all the things we explore, and I appreciate the insight that he gave us and his point of view. And part two is going to be a lot of fun, too. We've got Melissa Alvarez coming up on Animal Frequency right after this. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. And keep listening, because once again, I'm going to tell you how you can sample some of the best programming Gaia has to offer for absolutely free. Now, you're listening to the Paranormal Podcast, and that means that you love these topics. You want the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. But the question is, where do you go if you want those same topics in a streaming TV service dedicated to the topics we love? You're not going to find those topics on the major streaming resources. You want a resource that just tunes into these subjects. Well, there's only one answer, and the answer is Gaia. Gaia explores the topics we love and is always providing viewers with tremendous new content. For example, if you were a member this week, you could watch things like Buzzsaw, which is hosted by Sean Stone. This week, he's going to welcome in a fellow Gaia host, Regina Meredith, who hosts Open Minds. And Regina may have uncovered humanity's higher purpose, and they're going to talk about it on the episode entitled Rising Above the Chaos. Then Wisdom Teachings, hosted by David Wilcock, Sacred Sites and the Great Cosmic Puzzle. Beyond Belief with George Norrie is going to talk about exposing GMO agendas. Truth Hunter, Linda Moulton Howe, proof of presidential beings on the alien presence. Greg Brayton, Missing Links, ensuring humanity's continuation. All of these fascinating subjects, and all if you are a member of Gaia. But let me tell you this, if you would like to, I have a way that you can check out three free episodes of some of the best programming Gaia has to offer. All you have to do is go over to jimherold.com/Gaia. That's jimherold.com/Gaia. Over there, we have an episode of Buzzsaw, hosted by Sean Stone, Forbidden Knowledge for a New Age. Another one, Beyond Belief, hosted by George Norrie, The Truth on UFO Case Files. And Truth Hunter, hosted by Linda Moulton Howe, The Unheard Truth Behind Roswell's UFOs. So, my guidance to you, go over to jimherold.com/Gaia. Check out those episodes. You are going to absolutely love it. I know you will. I have no question you will. You're going to want to sign up right away. Check those out first. I know you're going to love it. You're listening to this show. You're probably a longtime listener. So Gaia is the perfect tie-in with the topics that we cover. And we thank them so much for their support. So, Check out those three free episodes of Gaia's great content at jimherold.com/Gaia. That's jimherold.com/Gaia. 5,000 years of wisdom on demand. Thanks, Gaia. Interesting subject today. Have you ever thought that animals have a soul, or that somehow you're tuned into them? You look at your dog, your cat, your pet, whatever it may be, and you feel like you're communicating. Well, you may be onto something. I can't wait to talk to our guest today. She is the author of Animal Frequency: Identify, Attune, and Connect to the Energy of Animals. And our guest is the author of this new book, Melissa Alvarez. She is a best-selling, award-winning author who has written 10 books and nearly 500 articles on self-help, spirituality, and wellness. As a professional intuitive coach, energy worker, spiritual advisor, medium, and animal communicator with over 25 years of experience, Melissa has helped thousands of people bring clarity, joy, and balance into their lives. She has appeared on numerous radio shows as both a guest and a host, and we're so glad to have her with us to talk about animal frequency. Welcome to the program, Melissa.
Thanks so much, Jim. It's great to be here today.
What inspired you to write Animal Frequency?
Well, I was mucking out a stall and communicating with my horse at the level of animal frequency, and it just occurred to me that, you know, I know how to do this, but, you know, I do this a little differently than normal animal communication, so maybe I should write a book about how to help other people learn how to do it. So that's where it came from, and it grew from a smaller book to a humongous book, and there's only like 200 animals in it.
Now, here's a question for you. You know, I kind of alluded to it in the introduction there. I have dogs. We're dog people. We don't have cats, but we're dog people. And when I see my dogs and you look deep in their eyes and they're looking at you, you feel like you're communicating. Now, is that just in my head, so to speak, or is there really a communication that's going on?
There's really a communication going on because you know your animal and you can tell a lot of times just from looking in their eyes. And if you've got an animal frequency connection going on, then you're connecting your energy with that to the animal. And sometimes you'll just know out of nowhere that something's wrong or what the animal's trying to let you know, because it is your pet. And, you know, pets are very important to people. So animal frequency is something that you can use all the time, you know, to help learn more about your pets and to understand, you know, if they have, you know, something going on with them that's out of the ordinary, or if they're just trying to tell you, hey, Jim, I love you. Will you pay attention to me right now? You know, because sometimes they'll do that. You
know? I want some food. Pay attention to me. That too. I think I get a little bit of that too. Now, when we talk about animal communication, is that the same as animal frequency, or are we talking about two different things?
They're similar, but to me, animal frequency has differences to it. Okay, so with animal communication, you are connecting to the animal through thoughts, through doing an image in your mind and then sending that image to the animal. And then a lot of times you'll get images back. People who are clairaudient may hear the animal say something. So you're doing a normal session like that. With animal frequency, you're amping your communication, your animal communication session up. So what happens is, the way that I do it is, you know, I'll be doing the regular session, and then I will send my energy from the heart forward towards the animal. Then I'll send it in my mind forward, so it's coming from all of me. And then you really connect to the divine. You go to the level of energy where your spiritual essence is at, and then you request that that animal connect with you and send you the message that it's trying to deliver. The animal will. You know, if you reach out to the animal will connect back with you. And then it's so cool because it's really like a merging of energies. And it's not that you have to say, or that the animal is saying, oh, well, this and this and this. It's more like you feel a part of the animal. The animal feels a part of you. And you just know what he's trying or she is trying to say to you at that moment in time.
Now, it's interesting here. You just didn't go with domestic animals. I think that would have been the easy thing to do, you know, like tune into the frequency of your pet and those kind of things. You have wild animals. You, of course, have domesticated animals. And you also have mythical animals, which I thought was brilliant. I guess I'll ask that third part. Why did you decide to include what many people consider to be animals that aren't real, or some that are in question, like Bigfoot?
Right, exactly. Well, because they are in mythology, because they are in our modern world, like Bigfoot, they do exist on some frequency or some level. We may not see them, you know, they're in the mythology, and, you know, they could be, where did that base come from? You know, where did that mythology base come from? So with those animals, and these are animals that, you know, most people love, you know, to talk about unicorns, or, you know, they feel a connection to phoenixes because it means it's a time of renewal for them. So why leave those animals out if they could be beneficial to help people with the connecting of the energy to them? So I figured I'm just going to put them in there too.
No. I think it's kind of cool. It's kind of an interesting piece. You also talk about dream animals in the book. Where does that come into play?
So when you dream, a lot of times it's easier for animals. Okay, so let me back up a second. Just like we have spirit guides who, you know, help us through our lifetime, that are on the spiritual realm of existence, animals are in that same realm. And the spirit of the animals, which I call energy animals, it sometimes is easier for them to connect to you through dreams, because we as people, and, you know, we'll put up blocks against it because we just sometimes you just don't want to know. You know, you see an animal on TV, you see an animal in real life, or then you hear about that same animal on the radio, and that animal just keeps popping up until you go, wait a minute, why? What's up with this animal? And it makes you realize something is going on, and that something is that it has something it wants to tell you. So if you're not listening and you're just ignoring and you're not trying to get the message, if the animal comes to you in a dream, oftentimes it can deliver the message without all that resistance from us, you know? So it's just easier for them.
Now, is there a thought that we have energy? For example, I had a caller who had a child. He's at the time, she called on the Campfire Show. I believe he was a teenager. He's probably, you know, over 20 now. This has been several years ago. And I believe she said when she was giving birth, she had a vision, like almost a dream. And it's been several years, so I hope I'm recounting this correctly. But the gist was she had a vision or kind of a dream of a wolf. And actually people were concerned about her because she was like panting and breathing heavily and all this. And that the child was born, and the child, his whole life has been fascinated by wolves, drawing wolves, wearing clothing with wolves on them, and all kinds of things. And so I guess he's an artist, if I remember correctly. And he was very into the whole motif of wolves. Do we all have animal spirits of sorts? I mean, are some people, you know, maybe some people would say I'm a turkey.
They might.
But do we have that? Is that something that's real?
I think so. And first of all, that is such a cool story, because to me, hearing that story, my first impression of that is that the wolf is the energy animal for that boy for his whole lifetime, and that the mother during the birthing process connected to the wolf energy that was just waiting for him to be born. So that is an awesome story. As far as having them for our lifetime, of course, it's just like we have lifetime spirit guides. We have lifetime energy animals. Mine is a horse. I've been connected to a horse since I was big enough to know what a horse was, you know, and it'll always be an animal that's with me and around me. So I believe that you have some that follow you your whole lifetime, and that you have others that'll come into your life briefly, you know, to give you a message. And sometimes the animals that show up may not be what you expect it to be. So, for example, say you love wolves, like this boy in your story, but all of a sudden you start seeing an ant, and it's like ants everywhere, and you can't get away from this ant thing. Then what does that ant mean at that point in time? So the wolf is with him forever, but this ant is coming along. So an ant may mean, okay, you need to reorganize, you need to work a little harder, or maybe you're going to be, you know, doing a lot of work for someone else, or maybe you're going to be in charge of organizing everybody, depending on what kind of ant he's seeing. So you may not see exactly the animal, or you may not be getting information from the animal that you love, but that animal that shows up has a message for you, and you should always pay attention to it, even if it's an earthworm, or, you know, it could be anything. So that's why there's such a wide variety of animals in my book, because each one of them can mean so many, you know, something completely different from the other one.
Our guest today is Melissa Alvarez. The book is Animal Frequency, Identify, Attune, and Connect to the Energy of Animals. We're having a great conversation, and we've only gotten started. We'll be back on the Paranormal Podcast.
If you like the Paranormal Podcast, you'll want to check out Jim's other free podcasts. Be sure to tune in to Jim Harold's Campfire, Crime Scene, and TV You Grew Up With. You can find them at jimharold.com and wherever fine podcasts are heard. Check them out. Bet you can't listen to just one. Now, we return to the Paranormal Podcast.
We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Melissa Alvarez. She is a best-selling author, and her most recent best-selling book is Animal Frequency, Identify, Attune, and Connect to the Energy of Animals. Melissa, you cover a lot of animals here. Which one's your favorite?
The horse. Well, no, just because I'm connected to exactly.
So tell us why.
Well, just because I'm connected to a horse, I have been my whole life. But there's some really cool animals that showed up during the writing of this book, which I thought was really interesting. I had alligators, snakes, red-tailed hawks, rats, I mean, lizards galore. You know, there's just everything just showing up my house. And, you know, I have 11 horses here, so my help was like, why are there so many weird animals around? I'm like, because I'm writing this book. And a lot of the information in this book is, I did a ton of research for this book. Okay, don't get me wrong on that, because I researched the animal's habitat, the air, the dirt, everything, you know, how does this animal live? Because I wanted to give a well-rounded presentation of the animal. And then what I also did is I used animal frequency to connect with each animal and ask them to tell me, what do you want me to include about you in this book? I mean, what is your message, and what things do people need to know from you? So there's a lot of information that is just intuition and information I received from the animal. So because I was doing that, they just came out of the woodwork, man. I mean, I was seeing them everywhere. I have a really cool story about a dragonfly if you want to hear it.
Oh, absolutely.
So one day I'm out in the barn and I'm working, and all of a sudden this whole group, I'm in South Florida, so we have a lot of dragonflies, and they'll fly into the wind and they'll rotate from the front to the back. And so I'm standing in the yard there, and this whole group gets around me, and I'm like, okay, this is weird, because usually they don't like surround somebody. So I move along and I'm doing something else. And then on my pitchfork, you know, because I was scooping poop out there, and on a pitchfork, I turned around, I looked, and there's a dragonfly sitting on the end of the pitchfork. I'm like, okay, so you must have a message for me. Just let me know what it is. A little while later, one's landed on my shirt. After a while, I had to go pick up my son from school. And you know that feeling when you feel like somebody's staring at you?
Sure.
So I get this feeling. I'm like, okay, it must be the person in the car beside me, because I was at a stoplight, right? So I'm like, nonchalantly look over to see if that person's looking at me, you know, and I look over, and sitting on my window was a little tiny baby dragonfly, and I just about freaked. I'm like, look at you. Oh my gosh, look at you. It was just amazing. So, you know, the dragonfly can be, you know, there's changes or transitions, and, you know, that really made an impact with me, that they just all day long, and then that little tiny baby was just staring at me through the window. It was great. So, you know, they can show up at any time, and at least unexpected times. You know, I thought it was the person next door, like looking over in the car or something, but no, it was this little tiny dragonfly.
Now, you talked about some different animals, and two of them caught my ear. Rats and snakes. I mean, when you think about rats and snakes, they get a pretty bad rap. And when you talk about their frequency and their spirit and so forth, is that kind of unfair?
Well, it is a little unfair because, you know, people are afraid of, you know, well, okay, first of all, so rats carry disease. That's not their fault. They just do. And because they carry more disease than, you know, most other critters, then we have a right to be wary of rats, okay, because we don't need to catch anything that they might be carrying. But if you really look at how a rat lives, they're very clean. Like, they have their own separate, like, bathroom area in their dens. They have everything organized within their dens. And with the rats, we've never had a rat problem around here. And, you know, even though we live on the canal, and in South Florida with canals, you can have rat problems. During the writing of this book, oh my gosh, I was seeing rats everywhere. I'm like, you guys need to leave, you know, because I don't want to have to, you know, end anybody's life, but I can't have this many rats around. And then once I put the word out, you know, and sent my energy and sent the message to them, you know, they left, you know, which was great for me. Now, for snakes, I think people are just afraid of snakes just because they're slimy and they feel soft when you touch them. And, you know, snakes can be scary, especially if you've got a cobra or a viper or something. And snakes can be poisonous, which nobody wants to get bitten by a poisonous snake. So with snakes, they have, you know, their own individual meaning. But I had a snake that showed up during the writing of this book, and she would just, I just thought she was a she, and I named her Ellie. And she would sun herself right here on the concrete between the house and the barn. So I would walk out, and she'd be sunning herself, and I would just run my hand down her back. It was a black racer. And I would just pet her and say, good morning, Ellie, or whatever. And that snake hung around for, I guess, probably 2 months. And then she left. So yes, some animals get bad raps, but there's usually a reason behind it, like disease or being poisonous or fear. You know, a lot of times people just are afraid of the animal.
Now, I'll ask you about my favorite animal, dogs. Talk to us about dogs. I think they're interesting, and there's a lot of people out there who are dog people.
Yes, there are a lot of dog people. I'm one, too. So, well, when a dog is trying to get a message to you, a lot of times what it symbolizes is loyalty, you know, because dogs are man's best friend. They are also a symbol of protection and service. Because dogs, you know, they'll give their life for you if they feel that you're being threatened, because they're fiercely loyal, and the love that a dog has for its owner or its family is phenomenal. I mean, that is an unconditional love that they give to you. Dogs also mean that if you need to work on communication, like with other people, like at your work, or if maybe you haven't been as happy or intelligent as you should be about things, then a dog is there to remind you, you know, you need to think a little better, a little clearer. And if you're thinking clearer, then you can see forward in your path, and that'll bring you more happiness. So the other thing you consider with a dog is, you know, what kind of breed it is, its size, you know, because it can have different meanings. And just connecting with that energy of the animal. So for instance, so what if you're connecting with a German Shepherd versus a Chihuahua? Now, I have German Shepherds and Chihuahuas. So with a Chihuahua, if you are connecting and you're just hearing yappiness, then that means maybe you're talking too much. Whereas if you're connecting with a German Shepherd and you just feel like a stealthy strength, maybe that's telling you to be a little stronger in a certain situation, because you can handle it, you know?
Interesting. Now, I don't want to upset probably 50% of our audience, so I have to ask you about cats.
Cats. Exactly. Okay, well, with cats, you have a little different situation going on, because cats are very regal. They can be very adventurous, too, and they're adaptable. So you can put a cat in any situation, and they're going to be fine. You know, the saying that a cat always lands on its feet? It's pretty much true. A cat also represents beauty, cleanliness, and being very clever about things. Because if you watch how a cat hunts, you know, they're very sneaky and clever when they're after a prey. Cats also symbolize having perfect timing exploration. Maybe when you see a cat, it's time for you to take a vacation or travel somewhere where you can get out and maybe hike or do something in nature so that you can actually explore an area. And cats also symbolize harmony and being at peace within yourself and accepting yourself.
All right. Well, do something a little more esoteric now. And we mentioned him earlier, Bigfoot. Bigfoot, what did you find about Bigfoot?
Well, first of all, I would love to see Bigfoot. I think a lot of people would. When Bigfoot shows up, you know, he's pretty elusive, and it's an indication of maybe you should be a little stealthy. It's also an indication that you're going to be facing something that is currently unknown to you. So Bigfoot can help guide you in that situation. Because it's also a symbol of invisibility. So say if you're in a situation where you're front and center, you're maybe say at work, you're the person who's front and center, you're leading a project, you're in the public view, and then you start seeing Bigfoot ads, and maybe it's a book about Bigfoot, or you see something about Bigfoot on TV. That's an indication that maybe you should need to take a little step back. Let somebody else be in the forefront for a little bit, because you can learn more and have more growth by being a little bit in the background and hiding a little bit. So it's almost like watching and listening instead of being out front.
Owls. I've always found them to be a little bit freaky. You know, kind of like they're looking through your soul.
Right, because their head spins.
And then there's actually some people who believe that, and it's way off the topic here, but some people think that aliens use owls as screen memories. So it really gets kind of complex, although an owl is supposedly wise. What did you find about the frequency of an owl?
Well, an owl's frequency is very resourceful. It does indicate wisdom. It also indicates adaptability, and that's because of the head turning. You know, when an owl shows up, it means, okay, you need to look all the way around you and see what's going on, because there might be somebody standing behind your right shoulder that doesn't have your best interest at heart. So you need to pay attention to what's happening in your surroundings and look everywhere, not just straight, you know, don't have tunnel vision. You need to look to all sides. One of the challenges of an owl is that it can tend to be secretive. And that means, are you holding too many secrets, or are you getting yourself in too deep because you're not telling the truth, or you're not being forthcoming? And an owl also is intuitive knowledge and knowing things on a soul level.
Interesting. What is the most unexpected of the animals, or something that surprised you in doing this?
What surprised me the most about this whole writing of this book was how many animals showed up. I knew that I would be able to connect to all these different animals, but I didn't think they'd show up in my yard. So that was the most surprising thing during the writing of this. And it was also very encouraging to me, the level of how the animals wanted to be part of this. You know, and I included a lot of animals in here, but I'm sure I could have included more. You know, they were just coming out of the woodwork. But there's only so much room in a book, you know, and I wanted to give a really in-depth accounting of each animal. So in the book, you'll find sections like the traits, the talents, challenges, the elements, what colors, the primary colors, and there's appendixes in the back of the book that'll tell you what the elements and what the color meanings are. So when you're working with the animal frequency and connecting with the animals, so say if you see a dream and it's a different color animal than you would normally expect in the dream, then if you look up the color, you can add another layer of meaning to the message that the animal's trying to send to you. And then I have two sections, appearances and what it assists with. And then two different things that I added in the book is in the section that's called frequency, I tried to explain how the frequency feels to me. Like when I connect to that animal, this is what it feels like. This is what it sounds like. And then I give a guided imagery to try to help the reader get started with its own, you know, the exercise to see where they're going to go with the frequency and the animal. That didn't make much sense. Anyway, it's like it's a little section to get you started in the imagine section. And then you might be reading what I wrote and following along in the guided imagery, and then you start seeing something that's on your own. Well, that's the animal connecting to you, so follow that instead of what I wrote.
This may be a little far afield. In some ways, it's more the animal connecting to your frequency. But I've always sensed, we talked about communication, but I've always sensed that animals know what is going on. You know, they know if you're upset, they know if you're happy, they know if you're angry. Did that map to what you found?
Oh, for sure, for sure. And not only that, you know, animals, they because they connect to you that way, they want to help you when you're sad. You know, they want to, you know, help calm your temper when you're angry. They're very understanding. And the spiritual messages that they can have for you, you know, the animal frequency connection is of the divine. So the soul of the animal is also of the divine, just like ours are. So when you connect to them on that level, it can help you so much. It's a tremendous assistance to understand where they're coming from and to help you grow on your own spiritual level by connecting with them. They're here to help us, and they want to help us. And sometimes it's just a lot of fun just to connect with them. I had one horse out here that when I was clipping him the first time, I kept hearing, "It's hot, it's hot, it's hot." And I felt the clip, and I'm like, "It's not hot. But it's hot, it's hot, it's hot." So I ended up getting 3 clipper blades and alternating them out because he was sensitive to the heat. So, you know, when you're dealing with animals like that, if you have the connection, then you can help them as well. Like, you know, he was uncomfortable with the heat, but it was not hot, but he was uncomfortable with it. So as long as I changed out the clipper blades more often, he was fine and he stood still. But if he thought it was getting hot, he'd start jumping around. So we can help them. They can help us. And it's just a lot of fun to connect with the animal kingdom in this way, with animal frequency. At least it is to me.
Is there an overarching lesson that they have for us?
I think it just depends on the individual animal. I mean, if overall, yes, because we need to, a lot of times we don't treat animals the way that we think that they really should be treated, because you might think of them as a dumb animal, or that, oh, it's just an animal, they don't have feelings. Well, they do have feelings, you know, and we need to be more aware of that to be able to help them more. So I think that would be the main overarching lesson that they would want to tell us. But they're really here to help us individually as well.
The book, Animal Frequency, and you can get it, I'm assuming, wherever fine books are sold?
Yes, it's available. The release date was March 8th, and it's available everywhere now. The Animal Frequency Oracle cards are only available at animalfrequency.com. Those I designed and I published to go along with the book. Llewellyn published the book, but I published the Oracle cards.
And how has this changed the way you think about animals? Because obviously you're an animal lover. You've had animals in your life for a long time. You've been an animal communicator. So this is not totally new to you. But how has maybe this project changed Melissa a little bit?
It made me have a deeper respect and a deeper love for animals than I did before. And just being able, because there's 100 wild animals in this book, and connecting to all those different animals, it just gives you it just makes you feel humbled and blessed that they would choose to communicate with me and to allow me to tell about them in this book. And I honestly hope I've done them justice, because it's really a respect for them, and I hope I got the messages across the way that they wanted them across.
Well, it has been a pleasure to speak with you about animal frequency. Identify, attune, and connect to the energy of animals. Check it out, everybody. Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you so much for having me on today, Jim. This was a lot of fun, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that show as much as I did. Wow. 2 great guests that really know their stuff and have some really interesting insight on some big questions. And if you enjoy the show, I hope you'll share it with a friend, rate, review, and most importantly, subscribe if you have the option wherever you listen. That's really important, because that registers us and moves us up in the charts, as do your reviews and ratings. So we appreciate it all. And we've got more great stuff coming for you on the Paranormal Podcast next week. So stay tuned, as they say, and we'll talk to you then. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.